The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Serra. On Tuesday, September 10th at 4:30 p.m., the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force will be holding a meeting at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room located at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue here in Corvallis. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On Wednesday, September 11th at 4:30 p.m., the Parks and Recreation Operational Advisory Committee will be meeting in person and virtually. The in-person meeting will be located at Corvallis Community Center Oak Room, 2601 Northwest Tyler Avenue in Corvallis. For details on how to join online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. On Thursday, September 12th at 10 a.m., the Downtown Parking Task Force will be meeting in the second floor boardroom at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library, as well as virtually. The Corvallis-Benton County Public Library is located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue here in Corvallis. For details on how to join the meeting online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Serra.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2, and it's repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KORC. You can stream us and find an archive of past news shows at korcfm.com. This is Dan Krall, and I am joined today by Wendy Byrne. She has been on a few past episodes in recent weeks of the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here. Good to see you again, Dan.
Indeed. Now tell the listeners why you are here.
I am trying to bring KORC some of the civics in the news, music, and civics program.
We much appreciate that.
I follow City Council pretty closely. I also enjoy following the Planning Commission and some of the other boards and commissions that exist for the city, and feel like I have a lot of information that other people might enjoy knowing, so I'd like to share that with the community.
You actually take the time to go to the meetings, and you know when meetings are coming up? And
I do. I go to a lot of the meetings, and if I've missed a meeting, it's really easy to watch them on Vimeo, because the city keeps an archive, and all of the meetings are recorded and then usually posted within 24 hours of the meeting, so you can backtrack to them or watch them again and again and again, and if that's what is your groove, like it is mine.
Well, we're glad that you are sharing your knowledge with us. And on the note of the Corvallis City Council being on Vimeo, it probably just helps for one to subscribe if they want to get regular updates, because we went onto the city website at least last month and we saw that it was a little bit of a hunt to find this information that should be readily accessible.
Right. The Corvallis City webpage is a little out of date. I won't say out of date. The information on it is current. However, the user interface is a little lacking. I think we can look forward to improvements on that in the future. But yes, Vimeo accounts, you can have a Vimeo account for free, and you can set that Vimeo up kind of like other platforms that allow you to click for notifications. So if there's a new upload, you'll get the notification. And the city of Corvallis also will send out notifications when they've uploaded videos, and that's a little bit of a labyrinth trying to find that part of the webpage, but that's available to be done.
I mean, I'm a 90s kid, so I appreciate the nostalgia of the 90s-ish website, but yeah, it should be a little bit more up-to-date, I think, for the folks. But one thing we try to do here on KORC News, Music, and Civics is bring local information that we understand is not always going to be available in the newspaper or otherwise. And so we do appreciate that Wendy Byrne is here to bring a perspective on some of the issues happening with the city council, with the time she has, as well as a keen interest in city politics. And from what I understand, we have a city council meeting coming up on Monday, September 16th, 6 p.m. According to the city website, which I was totally dogging on it, you know, with the 90s comment. But I mean, seriously, it could be a little more accessible. Anyways, according to the city website, everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend city council meetings. This meeting will be held in person and virtually. There's a published agenda at the city website. The public can register to watch the meeting live on the internet via a link that is provided, or it's going to be at the downtown fire station. Will you be there, by the way, Wendy?
I am planning to be at this particular meeting live and in person, yes.
What's going on at this upcoming September 16th meeting?
Particularly interesting to me that at this meeting they will be conducting yet another vote. This will be the third vote from City Council on this situation with the Courtyard by Marriott Hotel's conditional use application to tear down a couple of buildings downtown and build a parking lot.
And this is the existing Marriott Hotel, the high rise, right, that is located near 2nd.
It's located, it fronts 1st Street, so it's located, its address is on 1st Street, but it's in between 1st and 2nd, and, ooh, Washington and...
Adams.
Yes, Adams. I know downtown, like, I could walk through downtown blindfolded, but sometimes I don't get the streets right.
and this hotel, which I understand already has some kind of parking in place, they want a parking garage.
Actually, they have a parking garage. They have a parking garage that has somewhere in the amount of like 129 spaces. I think it's 3 stories. It's literally like the first 3 stories of the hotel is parking. They have purchased the building, one of the buildings that fronts 2nd Street, where that still the Cyclotopia sign is still up. So it's the old Cyclotopia building and another building right next to it. 2 small buildings, 2-story buildings. They would like to tear those down and build a single parking area with 10 to 12 parking spaces.
10 to 12?
Correct. Yeah, the information's in the application, which is available online, but I don't encourage anybody to waste their time going to look at that because it's pretty much what it sounds like. It is basically, they would like, what it looks like very much to me is that they are trying to create a entrance to their hotel. I mean, if you go there and you stand in front of the old Cyclotopia and you look towards the hotel, you can see the Courtyard by Marriott sign. It's up, it's basically atop the parking garage, right? And so if they tear down those buildings, and there is an existing curb cut there off of 2nd Street, because one of those businesses used to have a roll-up garage where you could park a delivery vehicle inside the business. So because there is an existing curb cut, if they tear down the building, they will have an entrance into a parking lot, and they won't have to create one. So it's technically not an allowed use of the property. That's why they have to have this conditional use permit.
Well, what's going to happen at the September 16th meeting regarding this process?
This process. So at previous meetings, the City Council conditionally denied this application. It was not a unanimous vote. It was 5-4 in favor of the denial. When they have a split vote, they bring it back for a second vote so that there's a little bit of time, and they also asked the staff to bring back a report supporting the denial. So they got the report for their next meeting, and then they had the meeting, and then one of the counselors changed their mind, and one of the counselors was absent. So the vote, the second time through, changed from denying the parking lot to approving the parking lot. So this will be the third vote, which they will have another report from staff supporting the original support for the parking lot with conditions, and then they'll vote on it again. And I don't know what's going to happen, so I want to be there to see.
Do you think that there will be more changing of minds from past votes that will now mysteriously or otherwise want to approve this?
You know, I'd sure like to see them just make a decision and stick with it, but...
I mean, 3 rounds of votes, that seems a little... Do they do this all the time?
No, not usually. If you watch City Council like I watch City Council, they usually reach a point in the discussion where everybody agrees, and most votes are unanimous. And when votes aren't unanimous, they don't usually change. Like, if a vote is, even if it's a split vote... you know, 5-4 in favor or 3-5 in favor or 3-5, you know, in denial. They usually hold to it. And if they vote again, that's usually what happens. It usually they stick with their votes. It's unusual for somebody to change their mind over something like this, my opinion.
We're speaking with Wendy Byrne, who is going to be at the September 16th City Council meeting, at least she plans to, and that is going to be at the downtown fire station. You can also join the meeting online. That is Monday, September 16th, and as you just said, there's going to be another round of voting regarding the Marriott parking situation. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like there's going to be a lot of discussion about the issue before the vote?
There might be some discussion from council. They're not allowed to hear any more discussion from the community because the hearing is not open. The hearing is considered closed, so they are no longer taking comments from the community, and they are no longer hearing arguments from either anybody involved in the situation. The hearing was closed. I could get the date in my book. The hearing was closed after the first time they discussed it, and when they voted to conditionally deny it, or to tentatively deny it, and they weren't supposed to hear any more about it, which is also kind of unusual. It's been a long time, and I'm curious how they're avoiding hearing more about it, since it's sort of been, in my world, it's been on Reddit, it's been on social media, there have been people discussing it. I even made the mistake of trying to discuss it with them at a meeting, and they correctly, the mayor said, "Oh, we can't speak to that subject tonight." And I didn't realize that I wasn't supposed to speak to them about it, so I withdrew my letter and took it home. But it's too late to say anything to them about it. They're not supposed to be listening to us.
Do you feel like when it comes to issues like this that the Corvallis City Council generally is receptive to public input?
I feel like our city council people do want to hear from the public. But I think I do feel like they are receptive. They really are interested, especially when different people come, when there's fresh faces that come with something to say, even if it's on the same subject. They are interested in hearing from as many people who will come to the meetings or provide them with input as possible. But the other interesting thing on a situation like this, which is a land use situation, it doesn't matter how badly you want it or don't want it to happen. If you aren't speaking to the land use code or the comprehensive plan, there's not much they can do. This is a land use issue, and what controls whether or not this is going to happen has to be in that plan or in that code. And if 20 people come downtown saying they really don't want to see this happen, if they aren't speaking to the relevant sections of the code or the plan, comprehensive plan, then they're supposed to put their blinders on and not hear that, because it needs to be objective. It can't be for subjective reasons, I guess what I'm getting at.
I feel like I learned that lesson a long time ago. I personally moved to Corvallis in 2005, and I had a lot more fire in my soul back then, being younger and just more radical and visionary or whatever. Not that I'm not now, right? But I do remember feeling like there was this vibe that, Corvallis is such a cool community where, of course, citizen input is wanted at the city council meetings. And this was about the Grand Oaks development. So it probably would have been around 2006 or 2007. Do you remember that?
I do, right, yes.
And a whole slew of people showed up in opposition. And I remember the reaction, the body language of the city council at the time, which was a whole different body of folks than is in there now. They were not interested, and there were emotional appeals on many levels about preserve the land. This is a beautiful place. Let's keep Corvallis unique. And I remember they pretty much voted unanimously in favor of the development, or maybe there was one opposing vote or something. But it was around that time that I, as a 20-something, new to town, I felt very shut out by the process. And I thought to myself, I sat through these meetings, listen to this and that. I'm not a meeting person personally, but it's good that folks like you are, because it can really sometimes be tedious to sit through. But, you know, the world is run by those who show up. Mm-hmm. And it really felt, at least at the time, around 2006 or 2007, whenever this was, just felt very much like, you know what, if I'm not going to be heard by the city council, I'm just going to bow out. And that may sound like an excuse. It probably is. But I just remember being very disenchanted by that at the time.
I mean, when I first started going to council, I would write them letters about different things. And I said, well, if I just go with the right message, it'll strike a chord and good things will happen. Or somebody will feel that they're going to get my back and they're going to take up this issue and they're going to, you know, do these things. And then I realized that everybody just smiles and nods their head and they may be very, you know, look at you like, thank you for coming, but nothing happens. And then I started to look a little further into it and thinking, I'm coming too late. Lots of times I'm getting to council with something to speak to when they're already in the process of making the decision. I'll tell you, the night that they are hearing the land use case is not the night to bring your letter to them and read it to them. It is, well, you need to get that letter to them well before the night they're sitting down to make their decision.
And we have, is it 9 wards here in Corvallis?
Yeah, 9 wards.
So wherever you are listening here in Corvallis, or if you're streaming us at korcfm.com, if you are a resident of Corvallis, you should know who your ward council person is. What ward you live in? I know I live in Southeast Corvallis, Ward 3. Wendy, what about you?
I live in Ward 5.
And your counselor is?
Charlene Ellis.
And mine is Hyatt Lytle. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Correct. Who won't be running again, by the way. So we have an election this November, and the candidates have all declared that we have 17 people running for city councilor in the various different wards. I think there's only 2 or 3 wards that are running unopposed. And Hyatt Lytle is not running again. There are 2 people running for Ward 3. And so I was really, it's exciting, not to change gears here, but it's going to be very interesting to see come January what 9 people are going to be sitting at the fire station downtown where city council has their chambers on the second floor.
The council chambers.
The council chambers, that's right.
On that note, I should mention that we at KORC, last week on the program, we had the voices of 6 candidates who are running for city council. If you are someone out there listening and you are running for city council, we want to hear from you. Send us an email, info@korcfm.com. Because we are giving you 5 minutes to present your case. It's equal time to everybody who is running. If you are running unopposed, we still would like to hear from you. A 5-minute statement. info@korcfm.com. You'll hear from either myself, Dan Krall, or JC, who is working with a number of city council hopefuls already. And we ran 6 different speeches last week, so we want to keep that going, you know, week to week until the election. And it's nice that we have folks like Wendy Byrne, who joins us today in the studio, who are willing to put their time and knowledge to work and also bring that information to the listening public. We have been talking about the September 16th, that's a Monday, September 16th city council meeting that is taking place downtown at the fire station and starts at 6 p.m. You can attend in person or virtually. Are there other issues they are going to be talking about that evening, Wendy Byrne?
I'm sure there will be. I think their agenda.
But the Marriott is the big one.
The Marriott's the big one for me because I've been following it and because I find it. I'm interested in the situation. I'm interested in what happens with the Marriott and the parking. But I'm also interested in watching how council's handling itself, because it is sort of an unusual situation. You know, sometimes the votes change, but it is not common, especially with our council. I feel like the way they usually discuss things, they usually come to an agreement and they try to stick to their agreements. And if there are legitimate reasons for changing your mind, so be it. But I also find that drama to be a little intriguing. So I'm following it on multiple levels. And I'm sure there are other things that will be on the agenda for that evening. And that agenda is available online at the city's website.
Have there been some mysterious... I mean, you said at least one council person had changed their mind.
Correct.
Who was that?
Ward 8, Tracy Yee.
She initially had voted against it, but then was in favor of allowing the...
Correct. And there was, if anybody listened to the segment that I recorded for the show a couple of Sundays ago, there was an article from the Gazette Times that spoke to that. And I read that article. It sort of covered briefly her statements that she made during the meeting about why she changed her mind.
Well, we are glad to follow this story in weeks to come, because every Sunday from 1 to 2, we are here on the radio and we want to bring you local information. If you out there in the listening audience would like to participate in what we're doing, info@korcfm.com is the email where you can get in touch. And we do hope to hear from Wendy Byrne in weeks to come, not just about the September 16th outcome. And as she has stated, she is following it with specific interest in the Marriott parking garage situation. But are there other issues that you are following within the city council agendas?
You know, I'm definitely following with good interest the people that are running, because I'm curious about what new energy they might bring and what might happen to the representation for the different wards. The city council is currently also undertaking sort of a large scale look at the strategic operational plan that kind of guides the actions of the city from year to year, and they're having discussions in their work sessions about what that plan is and what should be in it and what shouldn't be in it. And I'm watching that because I think that will be interesting. I think that's a good idea that they're doing that. I'm very interested in what is happening or what isn't happening with the situation with Charlyn Ellis, who happens to be my ward representative, but I'd be interested in that situation regardless of that I live in her ward. I'm interested in it because I find it to be, it points fingers back at the city charter, and I think the city charter needs to be updated, and that's going to happen next year, I think.
And when we consider that situation alone has cost the taxpayers of Corvallis over $150,000 just to cover these legal fees, stuff we could have spent on, oh, who knows what else. I think we should all be a little more keeping our eye on that.
Right. You know, and for example, during the last budget hearing process, a couple of counselors asked if there was any spare money, if they could build flush toilets in Central Park. And it would probably cost about $300,000 to build flush toilets in Central Park. And now we're looking at spending almost $200,000 on lawyers for a situation that we didn't need to spend money on at all.
And not to mention the land developers, that's a whole separate issue. Yeah, it's not looking very good, I'd say.
Yeah, I'd say I'd love to see that money spent on lots of other things.
I can agree with that. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2, repeated Mondays from 5 to 6. This is Dan Krall in the Southtown studio, joined today by Wendy Byrne. Thank you again for your time today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
The following is based on an article from KZI News on September 4th by Noah Chavez. A drone interrupted a Life Flight helicopter's ability to respond to a deadly rollover crash on Interstate 5 on August 30th, according to Staff Captain Sean Johnson of the Halsey Shed Rural Fire Protection District. Johnson was first on the scene, followed by other emergency medical service personnel attending to the two critically injured passengers, with the driver of the vehicle, Dustin Andrew Brown of Sweet Home, having died during the crash. Given the severity of injuries, Johnson decided to request a Life Flight helicopter to speed transport of the injured passengers to a local hospital, but the presence of a drone flying at the scene of the accident forced the helicopter to abandon its landing for safety reasons. This undoubtedly impacted the time it took for the injured passengers to arrive at the hospital. Oregon State Police said they're investigating who was flying the drone over the accident, and Johnson said he hopes this situation sheds a light on the importance of keeping private drones away from emergency crews. Information for this report was furnished by an article on KEZI.com, written by Noah Chavez on September 4th, entitled, "Drone Keeps Life Flight Helicopter from Assisting in Deadly Rollover Crash on I-5. You can find KEZI online at KEZI.com. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
Conducted an interview with the people at Flickr and Fur, who just received a grant to be part of the South Corvallis Food Hub. Let's listen.
I'm down here at Flickr and Fur, and you might notice that there is a drum circle just behind me back there. Don't let that stop you from listening to this very important report about the recent grants that were issued from the EDO, which we'll explain in a second, to a number of South Corvallis-oriented food providers of one kind or another as part of the creation of the South Corvallis Food Hub. So I'm here with two fabulous people who are involved with the Food Hub. We have Elisa Tuttle and we have Cheryl Good. Cheryl is the, I guess you are the marketing director and be all for Flickr and Fur. And why don't you tell me a little bit about what Flickr and Fur actually does and the role that you play here, because you didn't start off being like a farmer's market type operation, I'm sure.
No, we did not.
So what happened? What happened
there? What happened? I'll keep the story short. But okay. Flickr and Fur, really 13 years ago, we bought a property and we're like, wow, we should share this with people. And then we got some ideas would come our way. But the biggest idea that came was Rainshine Family Farm needed a place to do their CSA pickup. And we're like, well, why don't you use our place? It's perfect. It's in South Corvallis. Come do it. And they did that for several years and it was awesome. And then they literally bought the farm. They bought a farm out in Kings Valley and they couldn't do the CSA for 1 year. And their CSA pickup on Tuesday nights had become the thing we did on Tuesday. Like, Corvallis, the South Town, you know, we're kind of simple people, right? We just like to...
I'll let you address that. But
exactly.
Sure.
But, you know, hanging out with fruits and vegetables is what we can do and enjoy. But it became such a fun thing to do on Tuesdays. And when they bought the farm, we were like, what are we going to do on Tuesdays? Because they couldn't do that for a year. So we asked Bean Family Farm, we asked Trempler Family Farms, we asked some other farms to come down on Tuesdays and just entertain us with some food. And then it just grew from there. We were like, okay, then the baker wants to show up, and then other jams and jellies, things like that happened. So right. That was 10 years ago.
So today, 10 years mm-hmm. later,
yep.
there's a pizza oven directly uh-huh. across from me. There's a tamale cellar. There's one
booth.
Of the KORC DJs, Explorin' Lauren, has his own booth, and he sells yogurt and chanterelles. And there's Indian food, which I've purchased a time or two. It's all great stuff. So this space has started as like a farmette, and it still is for the most part. But now on Tuesday afternoons, you serve as a community neighborhood farmer's market, if you will. So Elisa, why don't you tell me a little bit about the EDO, you can explain that to listeners, and these grants that have just been issued in to help create a South Corvallis Food Hub.
Sure, yeah. So the EDO is the Corvallis-Benton County Economic Development Office, and they hired me. I'm a consultant. My job with them was to do a system assessment of South Corvallis and the food hub needs of South Corvallis. So Christopher Jacobs is a great person to talk to for more information about the EDO, but my focus was really to understand kind of what's happened in the last 12 years since the last food system needs assessment happened, what had changed, what had not changed, and what was needed in South Corvallis related to a food hub.
Right, and the obvious thing for those of you who don't know, both of you, is that South Corvallis has very little in the way of stores and opportunities for people to buy food. And how do you think that happened, or why did that happen?
Oh, gosh.
Well, this sounds like a long story. We may have to get into that
yeah.
at another time.
Well, there is the first alternative co-op, right?
Sure,
so it
obviously.
Grocery, but initially people think that's a membership, and so there's a little bit of barrier. It's not quite accessible sometimes for people to get into. Initially, they were very small. Now they're very large. It's open to anyone to shop. It's a great place to be there. And there's a whole demographic that's with new development down in South Corvallis. There's housing going in there. So now it's like, well, where else can we get food besides the co-op? and the restaurant, Southside Market, does some restaurant supply, so they do bulk rice and grains and things like that. But where else can you get it? And sometimes going downtown is a little hard to get to market, so Tuesday nights is a great way to get some food as well in the week.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the, I believe it's $495,000 that was just granted to, is it five entities?
Five recipients.
Five entities. So let's talk about the grant that you got at Flickr and Fur for your market that happens every Tuesday. And what do you foresee using that money for? How will it help you?
Really great. And we're so excited. So we focused on two areas. One was to strengthen the market, and one was to expand the market. So there's two focuses there, foci. Anyway, there's two ways you can look. It's all good. Anyway, so we have, the one is to strengthen the market. And one is like tonight, it's 80 degrees outside. We're looking at a lot of shade structures that look like they've used, they have rips in it, they have tears in it. So we put in some for some shade structures, from sun mitigation and weather mitigation. So when the rains start coming, we'll have a few more pop-up tents, but we're also going to have some permanent shade sails put up as well, so that pavilion there can actually be usable too, more than just on Tuesdays.
So that's a good point. You said when the rains come. So is this going to be like a rain-proof facility? Is that the idea?
We have a lot of really dedicated shoppers, and they'll come rain or shine. They'll come 100 degrees or not, so they'll come. But we go through the end of October until the time changes, and then it's just too dark. But we go through there, and we start again in May. But we do some pop-ups early in the spring as well. And so when the weather's good, we do a pop-up, usually in February, March, and April, and we get it going from there. So yeah, we'll be rain-proof. But it will be, we can handle the weather, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and besides, we're Oregonians.
We're Oregonians.
What do we care?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We
Come
can
on.
Bear
waterproof.
We're waterproof.
Let it rain. Oh, God, yeah. It's so hot today. No, just kidding. So, Elisa, what else do you foresee? Because I'm not going to go through all of the people that got all of the grants,
right.
But what do you foresee in the short term, or maybe even a little longer down the road? What are we going to see here in terms of what a food hub looks like and does?
Oh, good question. I mean, what I hope is that this grant process has kind of catalyzed energy, created connections in the food system, and above and beyond what this money will do, you know, physically in terms of infrastructure and, you know, buying electric bicycles and shade structures and food cart pods, it's really the relationships that it's helped to form, and who knows what can come of those relationships. That's really where the magic is, I think.
Okay.
To share some of our other things that we're going to do, because it was because of the brilliance of collaboration. Elisa was great about that, ensuring that, hey, let's collaborate. We're doing, what I like about this grant amount is there's a lot of pilot programs that are happening, so it's kind of decentralized. But once we have proof of concept, then, wow, we could get a building and we can make it all centralized. And not that it has to be centralized, but let's give an example. So one of the things we're going to pilot is a pre-order system. So our vendors or other vendors could drop off items here for people that have pre-ordered in a locked facility. So it's one of the things, just one of those little wooden sheds we can put up with a refrigerator in it, and they can come in and pick it up. Well, once that gets larger, a little self-serve isn't quite feasible. It's going to need to go to a permanent location. But we can run the pilot here initially, and because people are already used to coming to our self-serve farm stand as well, so they can just make it work. So that's a pilot program, for example. So we'll test it, see if it works. When then we can see what it needs to scale, and who knows, maybe it'll end up in that facility, another food hub, wherever that ends up being, or maybe it like moves over to Southside Market for a bit. Who knows what's going to happen, but we've built relationships through this process, and that's what's really fun.
And what's the time frame of something like that?
So that all the money is going to be allocated by the end of the year. We have to spend it by next year. So that program will be starting for next season. I'm anticipating the beginning of the year. One of the things I put in for was to work with, we're going to help the vendors get their product online, because my background, we worked with the Our Exchange, which is a local currency, for years, and when we went online, a lot of farmers and people are in the food industry because they don't want to deal with computers.
Sure.
And so one of the things we fell flat on our faces with is not anticipating that. Now that I went through that failure, we now know that, oh, we have to pay, we have to have a helper be paid to ensure people are going to upload their profiles and get it done. And then I'm really excited about partnering, the potential of partnering with Ten Rivers Food Web, because they are doing a, my understanding is they're going to do, well, you could talk about that, Aliza. You want, can you share about that?
Sure, yes.
Yes, let's do that.
So I'm also a volunteer with Ten Rivers Food Web, and they're another organization that receives some of the grant funds. And they're not really sure exactly what, you know, the future holds for their idea for a food hub, because they weren't awarded the full amount, and the partner application that they applied for wasn't awarded. So it will be something along the lines of wholesale distribution aggregation of local foods. So getting local small-scale farmers to be able to access markets like the school district, hospitals, OSU. There's big purchasers available, and our local farmers can't currently sell their produce to those big purchasers because they don't have a food hub aggregator like Ten Rivers Food Hub is looking to do for them.
Yeah. So that would be neat. And we might be able to use a similar platform and be able to do that. So those are some of the pilot. We're also going to look at a farm-to-table or farm-to-market pilot that we're going to do here as well. We're getting bike racks that are going to be able to be stackable and portable so that even when we're not using them, somebody else in South Corvallis can use them.
Nice.
And then we've got some marketing to go out into the world as well, some yard signs. We already have some out, but we're going to get some more and some coupons to some South Corvallis residents as well to encourage them to come next season so they know that we exist, so that we can get more bikers and walkers and people that come in. So I might have missed a few things, but those are some of the things I know we're expecting to do.
For taking the time to explain these grants that have just come through for your farm and for all of South Corvallis, I think it's going to be a great thing. Look for big things to happen in 2025, hopefully in more ways than one.
Exactly.
So thanks again for speaking with me, and we will stay in touch for sure.
Sounds good. Thank you, KORC. We're happy to have a local radio station hear about this first. We're really excited.
There you go. You heard it here. All right. Thank you so much.
For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
KORC has invited all candidates for city council to submit their candidate stump speeches and to discuss topics of concern to them and their constituents. For today's submission, we have two candidates whose speeches you will hear. We have Bree Lewis, who is running as an incumbent for City Council for Ward 2, and Charlene Ellis, who is running for City Council for Ward 5. All other candidates for City Council have been invited to submit their speeches to the station. Let's look forward to more speeches in the coming weeks.
Hey, my name is Bray Lewis. I am the current city councilor for Ward 2 that encompasses most of downtown and a little slither of Southtown and a third of campus. I've been in Corvallis since 2019. I have been actively involved since 2020 when the pandemic hit. I've loved this city ever since I came to it. I've had friends here who convinced me to move out here from Maryland. So I've been around politics my entire life, to the point I've, like, it almost got nauseating. That's what happens when you live next to DC. I'm a big advocate for housing and the housing crisis. I am big on education, especially being a toddler teacher, that inspiring little ones to be themselves is something I've always loved doing. Climate change is definitely real. I felt it even this past few weeks. Climate change is important, and we definitely need to do more to mitigate that. I've grown up through transportation. My mom was a bus supervisor for the DC Transit Center, and my dad worked with the train stations. So I've grown up around transit. So when I found out, when I first moved here and found out that the Corvallis Transit was free, I literally was over the moon. So those are definitely some of my big issues and concerns that I want to continue to work with if I get reelected. The main things I want to see going forward is transportation. I've been in contact with CTS. I've been working with CTS and MTR Western about what we can do with our electric buses and how we can get them actually, like, more efficient and back and actually on the roads. We do have some. They are there. It's the charging stations. is we're getting more charging stations, not just for the buses, but for everything. It's like I live in an apartment complex, and that's hard to have an EV in an apartment complex when you don't have a charging station. So I think it's like being able to like look at where we are. So we do have electric buses. They are there. It's the charging stations that we need to work on, because we don't have enough charging stations. Very, very rapid increase in more EVs on the road. And having a charging station at home is actually, you know, it's nice. It's a luxury that some people can have. It's not a luxury everybody can have. And I wanted to make that more of a essential. So to get that together, I also want to look more at our solar power. There is a solar energy board that was created by the Department of Energy, or the Oregon Department of Energy, in partnership with Pacific Power and the Energy Trust of Oregon and other agencies, to show just exactly where the solar is being implemented and how far along we are, as well as how far we need to do. So that's definitely something that I want to look into. I want to look into a lot of the stuff we have now is for homeowners and those who live in houses and who rent houses. I want to look more into more solutions for everybody. We have the OMA Energy Score that didn't go through. I understand both sides, like the home manager will help you see where you are and how to become more efficient. I understand though, like if you've already made those adjustments to your home and to your apartment and then having to spend more money just to redo it is a challenge. But I feel like it's something that will definitely be helpful to at least see where you are and make those improvements down the line. Not necessarily immediately, but down the line. So definitely getting those, and like those just flow into each other, transportation into energy saving. I want to get increased bus transportation, like bus ridership. And you know, we can only do that when we increase our driver capacity. We can only increase that when we have more buses. And if we can increase the more electric buses we have, the more riders we have, the more drivers we have, the less we are putting into the environment. And I think that's also a great way to mitigate as well. It's not a lot, but it's enough, because 1 degree Celsius is very different from 1 degree Fahrenheit. So it's like every degree matters.
I wrote this back in late January when the legal controversy over the charter was at its peak. A work colleague called me while we were wrapping up the semester. "Hey," he said, "I just wanted to touch base and make sure you were doing okay. I want you to know that I think you've always had real integrity, but I don't want to, like, intrude or anything." "You're not intruding," I assured him, "and thanks, I'm doing okay." What follows is, in retrospect, what I wish I had said. We each have a voice and a vote. First, I am okay because I am held in a deep and tightly woven web of community that is constantly showing support, often in quiet ways. A pat on the back in a meeting, a hug, an email, a letter to the editor or mayor and council, a stranger saying thank you at a public gathering. People talk to me on the street, at work, and in my front yard every day to show support. People I do not know, people I recognize from years of teaching here, and close friends, every day. If you ever wondered, should I say something to someone going through a difficult time? The answer is a resounding yes. Use your voice. Your support matters. Thank you. But more importantly, I wanted to let my friend know that he can, that he should be asking questions. As a citizen of Corvallis, of Oregon, of the United States of America, it is your right and responsibility to question the authority of your elected officials. Me, your city councilor, your city manager who works for you, your representatives at the county, state, and federal level. We are all here because you elected us to represent you while making big policy-level decisions. So, if you have questions or concerns, speak up. If you think we did something right, please tell us. You are doing your job as a citizen of the United States when you come before your elected officials and challenge our actions. You are not intruding. You are participating in our democracy, which feels particularly fragile right now. And so, please remember, we all have a voice and we all have a vote. People have suffered and died for your right to question authority and cast your ballot. Do not be silent. That is how democracy dies.
That was Charlene Ellis, who was running for city council for Ward 5. And before that was Bree Lewis, who is an incumbent city council member running her candidacy for Ward 2. In the coming weeks, KORC will continue its coverage of city council campaigns and candidates. For more information on your city council, go to CorvallisOregon.gov. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, heard Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m., and archived at our website, korcfm.com. The following is an article written by Brian Pacheco of the Drug Policy Alliance. Their stated mission is that they are the leading organization in the U.S. working to end the drug war. They are people impacted by the drug war who have lost loved ones to overdose, in recovery, some who use drugs, some who have experienced the harms of drug criminalization. Together, they work to end the drug war and build a better future shaped by love, not war. Oregon's drug recriminalization will cycle people in and out of jail without connection to care, failing to deliver the change it promised. This press release was written on August 30th, 2024. On September 1st, House Bill 4002, which reinstates criminal penalties for drug possession in Oregon, went into effect. The law marks Oregon's return to the broken, racist system of cycling people in and out of jail without connection to accessible addiction services or voluntary treatment. This effectively treats addiction and the overdose crisis as criminal problems, not health issues. The key takeaways: most counties have not set up deflection programs, which are vaguely defined, elective, and at the discretion of law enforcement. This means that the default response to drug possession will be to arrest and prosecute people for their addiction. Under drug recriminalization, drug use will be used as an excuse to arrest Black and Brown Oregonians at higher rates, who are statistically more likely to face incarceration and harsher sentencing due to targeted policing and enforcement. It will also increase overdose risk, as research shows that jails and prisons, as well as forced treatment, increase the risk of an overdose death. Oregon's dire public defender shortage means that House Bill 4002 will further backlog the criminal legal system, resulting in people arrested for drug possession having their cases dismissed due to lack of a defense attorney and released with no connection to services. The successes of Measure 110 should neither be downplayed nor contributed to House Bill 4002. Measure 110 provided to date over $500 million for addiction services, including low-barrier treatment options and a program already in place where police connect people directly to services without arrest. Instead of relying on the false promises of criminalization and forced treatment, policymakers should heed the research and provide residents with the resources, housing, and low-barrier health services they need to stay healthy, housed, and safe. The article at drugpolicy.org goes on to state, in 2020, Oregon voters overwhelmingly approved Measure 110, which decriminalized possession of small amounts of drugs while allocating to date $500 million from marijuana tax revenue and an additional $39 million from law enforcement savings to expand substance use disorder treatment, recovery services, housing services, and more. This funding resulted in dramatic increases in the number of clients accessing services. Since the beginning of Measure 110 funding, client counts have increased by 205% for substance use disorder treatment,
256% for peer support services, 167% for harm reduction services, 317% for housing services, and 573% for supported employment services. However, instead of addressing the urgent, long-standing issues of homelessness, public suffering, and an inadequate health infrastructure, by the way, issues that cities and states across the country were also struggling with in the years following the pandemic, Oregon leaders scapegoated Measure 110. The push to overturn Measure 110 was predicated on unsubstantiated claims that the law had negatively impacted the overdose crisis and public safety, despite research that showed it did not increase overdose or crime. According to Lindsay LaSalle, who is the managing director of policy at the Drug Policy Alliance, make no mistake, House Bill 4002 is taken from the same drug war playbook that has failed us for decades, cycle people in and out of jails, spend more resources on law enforcement that could go toward services people need, and saddle people, especially people of color, with criminal records that act as barriers to housing, employment, benefits, and education for the rest of their lives. Again, those were the words of Lindsay LaSalle, who is the managing director of policy at the Drug Policy Alliance. She went on to state, "The people of Oregon were sold a false bill of goods when corporate interests and drug war defenders, including the former chief of Oregon's prisons, told them that recriminalizing drugs and forcing treatment would solve the conditions that they were rightfully concerned about, such as public suffering, homelessness, and overdose. But criminalization and forced treatment do not address why people are struggling. Housing is unavailable, treatment is expensive and inaccessible, and many urgently need medical and social services. A return to criminalization means that, instead of connections to services or treatment, people struggling with substance use will be forced into an ill-equipped, complicated criminal legal system with a shortage of public defenders. They will likely return to the street in worse shape under the same circumstances and likely get arrested again. The people of Oregon deserve leaders that prioritize public health and safety over political convenience. We must refocus on investing in the services and supports that our communities need to thrive," added LaSalle. House Bill 4002 makes possession of small quantities of drugs a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 180 days in jail. The new law encourages counties to establish deflection programs that offer health services in lieu of arrest and prosecution. However, deflection is optional, at the discretion of law enforcement, and counties are free to determine the parameters of their program if they choose to have one. Only 28 of Oregon's 36 counties have sought state funding to implement a deflection program. In the counties that have begun preparation, most will not be ready by September 1st. In the remaining 8 counties, there will likely be no deflection option. The most likely outcome is that people will be arrested and processed through the court system for drug possession without meaningful connection to addiction services, which is in direct contradiction to the model that lawmakers promised Oregonians. House Bill 4002 is a return to the failed approach of law enforcement and the criminal legal system as the primary response to people struggling with substance use disorder, instead of health professionals and service providers. Research shows that people who are arrested and incarcerated are more than 27 times more likely to die from a drug overdose when they leave jail or prison. Forced treatment increases overdose risk. Research has found that people who were involuntarily committed were more than twice as likely to experience a fatal overdose as those who completed voluntary treatment. arresting people for drug possession also perpetuates racial disparities. Portland, for example, arrests and incarcerates black people at a per capita rate 4.3 times higher than white people, which is the fifth worst in the country. Understanding how these new criminalization policies will impact Latinx and black youth is our highest priority, said Mercedes Elizalde, who is the director of advocacy at Latino Network. She also said, youth who are being trafficked, abused, or manipulated into use or distribution could be subject to the harshest penalties while also not qualifying for deflection programs even where they do exist. The underlying structure of the deflection programs appear to require adults and youth to waive their medical privacy rights, both HIPAA and 42 CFR P2, in order to avoid jail. These challenges are made worse by the ongoing public defender shortage in Oregon, where there are less than one-third of the public defenders needed to provide constitutionally adequate defense to people facing criminal charges. Currently, courts routinely dismiss cases due to lack of defense attorneys. House Bill 4002 will further overburden public defender caseloads and result in people arrested for drug possession having their case dismissed due to lack of a defense attorney. This further increases the likelihood that connections to services or treatment will not be made, and instead people will be cycled in and out of jail and back onto the streets. According to Grant Hartley, who is the Multnomah County Director for the Metropolitan Public Defenders, by recriminalizing low-level possession, Oregon will exacerbate the unrepresented crisis, increase racial and ethnic disparities within the system, and funnel more money into the criminal system and away from treatment resources. Grant Hartley of the Metropolitan Public Defenders went on to say, these new possession cases will overload an already overburdened criminal legal system, crowding our jails, filling our court dockets, and adding to the backlog of individuals stuck in our system without a public defender, which as of August 23rd was nearly 3,500 individuals. This will undoubtedly lead to an increase in discriminatory policing and exacerbate the racial and socioeconomic disparities that plague our criminal system. Oregon still suffers a tremendous dearth of treatment services, and every dollar that it gives to the criminal system, which has failed for decades to engage individuals in treatment through the prosecution of low-level possession, is a dollar not invested in those necessary services. Those were the words of Grant Hartley, the Multnomah County Director for the Metropolitan Public Defenders. Joe Bezegi of Recovery Works Northwest said, we must not lose sight of our shared goal to create a system of care that works for everyone. He went on to say, in just 1 year of having our new facility up and running, we've provided medical detox to over 1,000 people. That wouldn't have been possible without Measure 110. With the Police Provider Connection Project, we have a successful deflection model already that needs resources to scale up. Let's build upon what we know works rather than doubling down on failed policies. Tara Hurst, the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, said, lawmakers promised that people using drugs would be immediately connected to care and avoid the criminal justice system. That's not what is being implemented on the ground. She went on to say, we can't arrest our way out of the overdose crisis. We all agree that addiction is a healthcare issue and therefore should be treated as one. People having to wait for a court date to get care is only going to result in more tragic and senseless deaths. Our communities deserve serious solutions, not a slush fund for more prosecutors. Public suffering is a homelessness issue that requires more housing, humane shelter, and immediate connections to care. Evidence shows Oregon's elevated overdose deaths were part of a national trend driven by fentanyl permeating the drug supply, not a reduction in arrests and incarceration. Public health approaches, not criminal ones, are needed to effectively address the overdose crisis and public suffering in Oregon and across the U.S. That was a press release released on August 30th by Brian Pacheco of the Drug Policy Alliance. Their website is drugpolicy.org. They are the leading organization in the U.S. working to end the drug war, repair its harms, and build a non-punitive, equitable, and regulated drug market. They envision a world that embraces the full humanity of people, regardless of their relationship to drugs, and they advocate that the regulation of drugs be grounded in evidence, health, equity, and human rights. In collaboration with other movements and at every policy level, the Drug Policy Alliance works to change laws, advance justice, and save lives. Their website is drugpolicy.org. This is Dan Kroll for KORC News, Music, and Civics.